supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
And Wendy Mendez. Mendez heads the Human Emotion, Health, and Psychophysiology Lab at UC San Francisco, where Sarah Waters is a postdoc, and published a fascinating study this year about how rapidly and in how many ways stress passes from mother to baby. Later, we'll hear from clinician Tamar Chansky about techniques to stop the stress.
I've got a story to tell on this show about how stress gets passed down from parent to child. My daughter Debbie was about 3 or 4 years old, and we were at Children's Hospital waiting for her to get her tonsillectomy. And we're holding hands, and she says to me, "Daddy, are you nervous about my operation?" Well, I knew the research back then, and I knew if I lied, she would know. And I said, "Yeah, honey, I'm a little nervous." And she looks at me, and she says, "Well, what are you nervous about, Daddy?" And I said, "Well, I'm nervous that if the operation doesn't work, you'll still get a lot of colds." So she stops for a minute, and she looks up at me, and she says, "No, Daddy," she said, "that's not what you're worried about." I said, "Honey, what do you think I'm worried about?" She said, "Daddy, you're worried that I'm going to die in there." Thud. She was right. I couldn't even let myself know it. These little beings, they absorb the emotion in the environment. Every parent has a similar story. Unfortunately, some children just absorb their parents' stress without talking about it. And in some cases, the children are too young to talk at all. Tamar, let's start with you. Emotional contagion, or what we call synchrony, is at the heart of parent-child relationships. If there is synchrony, a child feels felt, feels understood. But without it, there's difficulty in bonding. Tell us about what developmental psychologists call goodness of fit.
Dan, the way to look at this really is, in any given moment, the parent is feeling something, the child is feeling something. It's sort of incumbent on the parent to be picking up on the cues of what the child's feeling. That synchrony is that there is sort of that internal feeling of all is well in the world. If there isn't that synchrony or there isn't that matching, lots of things fall out from that. The child doesn't feel understood. But even infants and early on, there's that feeling of dis-ease that happens.
Wendy, I want to turn to you, and I want to understand what this phenomenon is. I mean, there's got to be some evolutionary purpose of that.
Right, absolutely. So when we think about two adults interacting, what we often will see is a lot of mimicry. People mimic the posture, the facial expressions, maybe even something like the word choice. And that helps facilitate interactions. We're more likely to mimic people who we like, and people who mimic us, we're more likely to like them. So it does serve a special feature to not only bond and understand each other, but also to help facilitate empathy. If you're feeling sad and I mimic that facial expression, I'm sort of putting myself in your shoes. So that mimicry helps us both facilitate social bonding, it helps us understand or have a shared reality with the other person, and this can help all of our social bonding. And what we did in the study was really about taking this adult phenomenon that we know well and ask, do infants, pre-verbal infants, actually have the same kind of mimicry? Can they catch the emotions and stress even before they have that exquisite ability of language?
Well, that sets up Sarah here. So, Sarah, tell us about the study. I want to know what population you looked at and what you were looking for.
So as Wendy set up, we're really interested in thinking about synchrony. And as Dr. Chomsky was mentioning, so much of the developmental literature has focused on the child, maybe elicited a stress response in the child, and then looked to see how the parent responds to that. So with this study, we kind of took the reverse. We looked at the parent, and we thought about what the mother is actually bringing into the situation, and from the perspective that this might be a very adaptive thing, because we know that infants at this age, these babies were 13 months old, so they were maybe developing their first words, many of them not speaking at all yet, most of them not walking yet, so being held by their parents a lot. We know that right at this age, babies have already come to understand that their caregivers are really important sources of emotional information in the environment. So if they're in a strange kind of setting, like when you come into the lab and there's all of these experimenters and strangers interacting with you, that if you don't, as a baby, know exactly what's going on, you're going to look to your mom and look to her emotional response to see what, how to feel about the situation and what's going on.
Well, the lab that Wendy runs, Sarah, and that you work at, one of the words is psychophysiology. So Let's talk about the physiology here. What's happening?
So we know that this emotional transmission can occur behaviorally, or we've looked at it behaviorally, looking at facial expressions and eye contact and things like that. What we were doing was taking it to another level to look at what goes on in the mother's body physiologically. So things like heart rate, things like activation of the sympathetic nervous system, this fight or flight kind of stress response inside the body, how that those changes occur in the mother, and then whether we see similar or comparable or synchronized changes in the infant.
How do you measure it?
We use things like electrocardiography, so EKG, kind of like what happened when you go to your cardiologist, where they put little skin sensors on your body, and then we're recording each heartbeat, each change in the cardiovascular system into the computer.
I wonder, Wendy, back to you, I wonder if what we're seeing here is kind of empathy in the extreme. I know you can't use the word empathy with infants, but the physiology is similar.
I mean, I think it's fair to say that one of the emotions or mental states that helps with synchrony is empathy, trying to take the perspective of the other. I think with the current study that we're talking about with babies, it's not so much empathy, but more attunement to the mother. So what was sort of remarkable about this study was that the mother experienced something very stressful when the baby was in a different room, or she experienced something very relaxed. And when the baby was reunited with the mother and placed on her lap, instead of relying on facial expressions or even voice frequency, what we simply looked at was a number of surface recordings from the mother and the baby. And what we saw is that the baby's physiological responses matched the mother's within minutes. We think touch is one of the likely mechanisms through which this stress contagion can occur. It could be lots of things. The baby could be looking at the mother's facial expression and responding to either a scared or concerned look. Maybe it's odor. When we're stressed, we put out different scents, and maybe the baby is picking that up. In our study, when we reunited the baby, we put the baby right on the mother's lap, and the mother held onto the child. Touch is a powerful mechanism through which our emotions are communicated. And especially when you're thinking of 12, 13, and 14-month-old children, they're getting a lot of information from that touch. Though we didn't isolate touch in this current study that we're talking about, we think that touch is this likely mechanism through which the babies are picking up on the mother stress and then responding physiologically with changes in the baby's sympathetic nervous system response that then matches the mother.
All right, I want to take it the next step, and I'm going to ask all parents listening to me right now to please forgive me. But I want to talk about the parallels between interactions, a parent's interaction with an infant and a human's interaction with their dog. Now, stick with me here. So when an adult is feeling stressed and they pet their dog, they calm down. So when a parent is feeling stressed and they hold their child on their lap, I'm guessing they calm down also.
We do think we see some evidence that the presence of the baby helped regulate or helped calm down the mother. I think those kinds of very careful study where you're focusing just on the parent or the caregiver's responses are very critical. It wasn't quite what we were doing here, but I think that intuition is right. Just ironically, about 10 years ago, I had a study with the presence of dogs and cats, and we put adults through a very stressful interaction, measured their physiological responses, their blood pressure changes, their cardiovascular changes, and they either did a stressful task, very similar like what we did with the mothers and babies, in the presence of their dog, their cat, or their spouse. And without question, the most stress buffering, the most beneficial effect on the stress response occurred when your beloved pet was present and your spouse was actually quite bad at helping regulate your stress. So I think there is some parallels there.
Yeah, you know, there's some ethical issues here. You know, in this country, we've got marital issues and people are getting married less. And here you are saying that pets are better than spouses. I want to.
Spouse was better than being alone, though. Being alone was the worst.
I want to turn to Mark, because I have a feeling that we're going to have a lot of parents out there that are already close to having anxiety disorders. Tamar, before we go to the caller, I want to know if you've got experience in your work with how parents and children can together get more attuned to each other in a positive way.
Yeah, I was going to say get more attuned to each other, but also be aware of when anxiety is what is driving the parent. You know, it's a little harder when we're talking about 13-month-olds to mediate verbally, although you can. But if, let's say, you're sitting and talking to your 7-year-old who's really nervous about going to a dance class for the first time or something like that, and you're nervous for them too, but you have the ability to say to yourself and to your child, that's my worry talking. So part of me is worried about what's going to happen when you go to that class, because you haven't liked other classes that you've gone to. But another part of me is curious. Another part of me is kind of excited. How about you? You know, there's an opportunity there through language to take hold of your relationship with that anxiety.
And when you respond out of anxiety, you're probably giving advice or trying to talk them out of their anxiety, or what I call stupid parent talk, what we all tend to do. Let's go to the phones. We've got Mark on the line. Hey, Mark.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. My son is 26 now, and just before he was born, my wife's mother was diagnosed with terminal cancer. My mother-in-law then died about 8 months later. We went to see her every weekend as she got worse, and my son was brought with my wife and myself. My mother-in-law was allowed to hold him, and my question is, now having the knowledge of listening to you guys talk, I'm wondering if you can just give me some ideas as to what type of an impact those interactions may have had on my son and also my wife.
Let me give you a rule of thumb about this, and then we'll turn to the real experts. It's never about the thing. It's always about what the thing means to us and how we deal with the thing. It's never about the thing. Tamar?
I'm nodding my head in agreement. Mark, it's wide open. The basis of cognitive therapy, but really of life, if you think about it, is it's not the event. It's the story that we're telling ourselves about it and how we process that. And that could have been an incredibly bonding experience for you all as a family. It doesn't have to be a bad thing.
Sarah, do you want to weigh in on that?
I totally agree. I was also nodding that it's the meaning that's made. And I think that one of the things that we can forget sometimes, because we want to be in these beautifully synchronous and attuned and positive states with our children, is that much of the time we're not synchronized. And actually, those periods where there's stress, where there's upset, where there's a lack of synchrony, is the opportunity for reparation. It's the opportunity to reconnect. And that's a very powerful message that you can teach with your child.
I see the clinician across from me nodding her head in agreement. You just made her happy.
My fMRI is going crazy right now, right?
We're talking about emotional contagion, specifically transmission of stress from parent to child. Tamar Chansky is a child psychologist specializing in anxiety disorders. Wendy Mendez is a professor of psychology and head of the Emotion Health and Psychophysiology Lab at University of San Francisco. Sarah Waters is a postdoc in the same laboratory, and she's the one that did the study that prompted a lot of this discussion. I want to talk about what we can do about it. Wendy, now I'm going to jump back to adults here. We know from the work of John Gottman that emotional synchrony is at the heart of good relationships, and no matter what relationship, can synchrony be cultivated, nurtured physiologically, psychologically, or biologically?
Well, you certainly can increase emotional synchrony with partners, but also with strangers. Some of these effects happen below awareness. We're not even aware that we mimic or achieve emotional convergence with people. In fact, one of my favorite studies out of Kent State, you'll love this study, Dan, because it took interviews, specifically Larry King interviews. What they did is they extracted this voice frequency from these Larry King interviews. What they found is that within a few minutes of two people talking to each other, in this case Larry King and somebody else, that the voice frequency converged. The two people's pitch and voice frequency within a few minutes had the similar cadence and low frequency signals. Now, I don't imagine that Larry King or the person he was interviewing were aware that the voice modulation that they went through in the first few minutes basically ended up matching each other. There was one other really interesting part of this finding was that they looked at the Larry King interviews when he was interviewing people who were presumably higher status to him, heads of state, royalty, and also interviews where he was interviewing somebody presumably lower status to Larry King. What they found is that the person who was higher status, the lower status person would modulate their voice to match the higher status person. So in other words, the higher status person sort of set the tone for the interview. So if Larry King was interviewing a head of state, Larry King would modulate his voice. If his interviewee was presumably lower status, the interviewee would modulate their voice. Why I think this is an interesting finding and relevant here is that people have very little knowledge of the minor modifications they make to their behavior, their expressions, their voice. But again, it's partly in service to achieve affective synchrony or convergence with our partners.
You're right. I love the Larry King study. You're absolutely right. Let's go back to the phones. We've got Miriam on the line. Hey, Miriam.
Oh, hi, Dan. Thanks for taking my phone call. I'm finding this conversation absolutely fascinating. I'm a 21-year-old home from college and has always suffered from a lot of anxiety. I had trichotillomania as a fifth grader, and the reason I'm calling is because I am curious about stress in utero. My first husband died. I found out I was pregnant 6 weeks after his death, and I had a 2.5-year-old daughter as well. And as much as I tried to make my home secure for these kids, my daughters who I adore, I know that there were things that I went through physically that there was no controlling the stress factor during that situation. And I have always felt that her anxiety, the way that she operates, were as a result of that stress.
Well, we're going to hear from Sarah in just one second, but I also would guess that right after the birth, and you were still in mourning, that you had to, well, even with a 2.5-year-old right after the death, you had to steel yourself from your own grief and fear, God knows what other emotions you felt, so you could function.
It was a full plate, and, I was quite aware that they depended on me, but I tried my best, and I know that they had to be affected in some capacity.
Yeah.
Certainly. Well, it's the second one more than the first.
It's a good guess, certainly. Let's hear what Sarah has to say.
Well, Miriam, it sounds like you were incredibly courageous through a really challenging time. And I think two things. One, there is research emerging about pregnancy and the prenatal period as being a really important time for development, that the experiences of the mother, the psychological experience of stress and things like that, are part of the environment that the fetus is developing in, and begins this bidirectional relationship between mother and fetus right from the beginning. So there is something to that. And I think my other point is to really emphasize just how continually responsive and changing we are as people, even our physiology, even our stress systems and things like that. So you go through these really difficult times, and one of the opportunities that emerges is to be able to teach your child that we survive these things. And like Dan was mentioning, we can become even closer and learn to regulate and to manage and to make meaning of really powerfully tragic and intense emotions.
Yeah, Sarah, you even said that stress, good fodder for resilience.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. That we, of course, we want to protect our children and not let them be exposed to a lot of stressors. At the same time, overcoming challenges and even getting into a conflict and then finding resolution to that is actually a really important lesson. It builds resilience, because we can't protect our kids or ourselves or anyone from the challenges of life. It just comes no matter what you do. And so being able to know that, you know, you and weather this storm, that's really powerful.
Miriam, thanks so much for your call. Tamar?
I think things that parents do to survive a situation, that's a model too. It's not just the stress. And also that there's kind of a time and place for everything. And I've certainly seen kids who have gone through very difficult times early in their life, and they're at a point maybe in their teens or middle school years where they're really able to take it on and learn a lot about themselves of how they got through.
Well, you know, I found that with both of my daughters. Debbie, she was 5 years old, and my other daughter, Allie, was six when I had my accident, became a quadriplegic. And right from the beginning, I mean, these kids lived with trauma, but they were also helping their dad. And so both of these women now care very deeply about the larger world. They've got great passion about helping, you know, one with people and the other with animals. So that's the good news about parental stress. Let's go back to the phones. We've got Pat on the line. Hi, Pat.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I am the child of a super, super stressed out parent, and I want to know what to do now.
Yeah, that's the question. Tamar, what can we do to stop history from repeating itself generation after generation?
A lot of times the parents I see, maybe not surprisingly, have anxiety themselves. They're coming in for their child, but they're struggling as well. And often I will say to them that their empathy can go one of two ways. Either they can use that to be predicting danger and threat in a situation, sort of modeling that for their child and letting history repeat itself, or they can go a really different way with it. And through their understanding that they can really just be with their child, ask questions, share the job. You know, there have been studies that look at what are the mechanisms by which anxious parents may pass that on to their kids. And one of the things that they do, we were talking about touch earlier in the program, is a parent kind of rubbing the child's shoulders when they're waiting to go into the doctor's office for the shot is actually a way of transmitting fear.
Yeah, it's, like, it's what we talked about.
Right,
touch.
You're telling your child, okay, this is a dangerous situation, or this isn't a good situation, you know, so be on alert. But again, your empathy is a way of stepping back and communicating with your child, asking them, what are you worried about? Let's talk about it.
There is something that I have brought up, I think, every show, and that's self-compassion. I mean, when you are anxious as a parent, you need care. You need kindness and compassion. That's got to be step number one if you're going to be a good parent. Because I got to say, and Wendy, you know, if I was a parent listening to the show right now, I'd be scared to death. I'd feel like every emotion would be picked up by my child, and I dare not be a parent until I spent at least 5 years in some ashram in Tibet.
Well, we certainly wouldn't want people to walk away with that impression. And I think this is a perfect time to make the distinction between acute stress and chronic stress. The last caller, Pat, was really describing an oppressive, chronically stressful environment. I actually want to separate that for a moment, because children who are raised in something more chronic and always there, I feel like that's a different situation. We all have ups and downs in our everyday lives. People who work and good things and bad things happen.
But that acute stress, it motivates us in some occasions. Stress can be good for you. It also can be damaging. It's not completely straightforward that it's always bad. What Tamara and Sarah were saying before, the story that we make of it, the meaning we try to make out of it, I think the point is that when your child is picking up on your emotions, you can't just assume that only the bad emotions are getting through, the good emotions are getting through, but also that there can be something learned from the negative emotions that we learn to regulate. If somebody is angry and you learn to calm down kind of within the moment of anger, your child is picking up on that, learning how to regulate their emotions early on because you're effective at regulating your emotions is a powerful skill to learn early.
That's really the deal. And the other thing and is that biology is not destiny. I want to know about this transmission business a little more, that if I come home and I'm feeling distressed, and there's a little baby there, should I keep my distance? I guess I'll turn to you, Sarah.
I think that's exactly what people wonder, and I don't think that that's the message. We know that babies love to be connected, that they come into the world right from the beginning really primed for social connection, gazing into their caregiver's faces and learning that social smile right from the beginning. I think that what we do want to kind of put out there, suggest from this study, is to be, you use the word self-compassion, or to be mindful of what you're bringing into that interaction with the baby. And we talked a little bit before about whether it's soothing to the mother to pick up and hold that baby. So are you coming to your child in the moment? And I think that there's maybe no other time that it's easier to let go of the stress that happened a few moments ago, to let go of the future and what and all of the unknowns, and to just be present and in the moment when you're gazing into your baby's eyes and doing the verbal and nonverbal dances that you can do.
And if you and if you're in the midst of a crisis, if you can do that for 30 seconds, it's a good thing. And
exactly.
Don't expect yourself to be able to do a whole lot more than,
exactly.
than 30 seconds before your mind takes you away.
We were listening to Dr. Dan Gottlieb's conversation with Tamar Chansky and researchers Drs. Wendy Mendez and Sarah Waters from UC San Francisco about contagious stress. You're listening to Voices in the Family, and we'll be right back after this break.
The Solana Doylestown and Atria Senior Living Residence proudly supports WHYY. Opening this fall, the Solana Doylestown will offer independent living, supportive living, and memory care options for older adults. Details at solanadoylestown.com.
I'm Dr. Russell Kaufman, president of the Wistar Institute. Wistar proudly supports WHYY and announces the opening of its new 7-story Robert and Penny Fox Tower, designed to accelerate scientific discoveries. Here, Wistar scientists are working together to create cancer treatment vaccines. These unique vaccines direct the body's own blood cells to attack cancer cells. Learn more about this and other advances at Wistar.org. The Wistar Institute. Today's discoveries, tomorrow's cures.
Supporting WHYY, the Pennsylvania Farmers Union. Family farmers working together to ensure the survival of a diversified food system by serving as a vital voice for family-scale agriculture. More information at pafarmersunion.org.
Welcome back to Voices in the Family. I'm Gita Simons, in for host Dr. Dan Gottlieb. Before we explore solutions to stress, from the creator of the mindfulness-based stress reduction program, Jon Kabat-Zinn, we'll hear Dr. Gottlieb discuss how stress affects adults. He'll do this with Dr. Veronica Engert from the Max Planck Institute for Human Cognitive and Brain Sciences in Leipzig. But first we'll start with Dr. Michael Boehm, director of the Penn Program for Stress Management at the University of Pennsylvania. Here's Dr. Gottlieb discussing where good stress crosses the line.
Michael, some stress has to be good and bring valuable information, and some stress is just toxic. So if I'm hearing an angry dog barking and I see it coming towards me, I'm going to feel stress and get the hell out of there as quickly as I can. I don't want to be mellow and say, oh, there's a barking dog.
Right. If that dog is coming towards you, it's best to leave as quickly as possible.
Good.
There's a reason why this is built into the system. I mean, we didn't decide to have this stress thing happen. We didn't have a choice. It's hardwired into us because when it's necessary, it saves our lives. It motivates us and channels all of the energy that we have to do something about whatever it is, the saber-toothed tiger that's trying to eat us or the dog that's chasing us down the street. But when we imagine it, when we think about how awful things will be, we kind of live in that awful future, and it's not real. So we've actually created a stressful event, and then we live through the consequences.
Veronica, I'm trying to look at what Michael said quantitatively, and do we have any research showing that there's a point in which, in individuals or in groups, a point at which that stress turns from adaptive to self-destructive?
There's definitely a lot of research on that. This is what the stress response physiologically does. It supplies us with energy for exactly what we have to do, either fight that dog or run away from it. And we can say that this is adaptive, and it becomes adversive or it becomes unhealthy if it's chronic. Chronic can be different for different people, but essentially, if we are in a state of chronic fight or flight, this is when research has shown that what the stress does with our body becomes unhealthy. So, for example, the increased levels of glucose on long-term could lead to diabetes. Blood pressure on long-term could lead to cardiovascular disease. The immune system could get weakened. So we have all these long-term effects of chronic cortisol exposure that won't do us well.
There's also an extensive study of children who were exposed to chronic severe stress, and it's changing their brain size and structure. These kids are more likely to have life-altering learning disabilities, become depressed, suicidal, break long bones, and have cancer than other kids. I mean, it's devastating on the body. So I wonder, and I want to turn to you, Michael, about cognitive deterioration with sustained stress. That's the very organ we need to help us resolve stress, and that organ isn't working so well.
It's really true that at the moment when we need to have our wits most about us, they're not available at all. And so we revert to old habits. Maybe we raise our voice, or sometimes we raise our fist. And those are never things that we would choose to do in our most reasonable adult moments. But that reason becomes out of reach. We tend to get emotionally exhausted, and that is the core symptom of burnout. It decreases our ability to empathize, and it decreases our ability to perform. But it's clear that there's another side of the coin, and as we've been talking about contagious stress, it's been occurring to me that lots of other things are contagious in exactly the same way, like love, like caring, like closeness, like trust. These are things that we feel from others, and when we feel that from others, we share that feeling.
I remember an experience I had years ago. Veronica, you don't know this, but I'm a quadriplegic, and in that context, as a therapist, I see a lot of people with various disabilities. Years ago, a mother brought her son in, who was also a quadriplegic, a new one. He was about 17 years old, and what struck me about this young man was that he was gorgeous. I mean, he was like a Hollywood beautiful kid. And I listened to their story, and I told them a bit about mine. I showed them around my house to show them what was wheelchair accessible and what that could look like. I showed them my handicap van that I drive, and they left and they thanked me. They both looked much better. So that was an example of my empathy helping them. But as soon as they left the office, the young man turned and looked at me and thanked me and pushed his wheelchair out the door. And the second the door closed, I began to cry. I cried knowing what that beautiful kid was going to live with for the rest of his life. And I wondered, am I a hypocrite? Was I in denial? Empathy on both sides of the coin. So it really is not black and white here at all. Any thoughts about that, Veronica?
I think there's some very exciting new research from the group of Tanya Zinger. That's
speaks to what you just said. It goes into looking at the difference between empathy and compassion. Empathy, we feel with somebody, right? This can be great in case of positive emotion, but in case of something negative, it can become quite taxing. And then there's compassion, and it's being suggested more and more that compassion is really something that goes beyond empathy, and compassion would be the care and motivation to help. And there is some really exciting new research that shows us that compassion might really be the key to better dealing with the suffering of others. So it seems that it doesn't necessarily reduce the negative feelings that we have when we see other people suffer, but at the same time increases our positivity. This could be a clue of how we could learn to not be too taxed by our feelings for other suffering.
Michael, you and I both have a lot of passion about this topic, and I know you've done an awful lot of research in this about even the physiology of compassion, and you see it acted out in your classes and in the workplace.
Well, compassion begins with being able to feel what's happening in the other person. But then there's something that's added to that, which is the ability, even though we're feeling that distress or that suffering, to hold that in a bigger space, not to be trapped in that suffering, but to resonate with it and to care for it. And that is absolutely something different, and it comes from the best part of ourselves.
And nothing begets compassion better than vulnerability of the other person. And they do go hand in glove. When you are vulnerable, I feel compassion. It's almost an automatic response. So talk about connection and relationship, and this is how we've evolved as a species, and this is how everybody's afraid we're going to devolve as a species.
Right. You can think about two people who are experiencing the same degree of distress, one really angry and one not, and you just feel how different it feels and how much easier it is when someone lets you in and allows a little bit of that vulnerability to be felt and known.
We're talking about contagious stress. My guests are psychologists and researchers Veronica Engert from the Max Planck Institute from Leipzig, and Michael Boehm is a physician and director of the Penn Program for Mindfulness. So I want to ask a question. I wonder if compassion that we've been talking about can be taught or learned or improved. Any research on that?
There is definitely research that shows that you can learn compassion, and we are in the middle of a huge study in which we teach people who have never meditated before, who we introduce to this concept and to the ability to have feelings of compassion and of positivity towards other suffering. And well, I can't tell you about the results just yet, but there will definitely be a lot coming. We're looking at brain structure, and also at cortisol levels on a baseline and in response to stress. And there will be a lot of answers coming up.
Can we learn empathy and compassion even if we're not born with it? People we label as narcissists or psychopaths, can it be learned?
Well, I do think it can be learned for us, but it would be more difficult for somebody with a narcissistic personality to cognitively understand the concept, definitely. But maybe this I can give on to Michael. Maybe you know more about how empathy can be learned in certain disorders.
Here's what I wonder, Michael. I mean, you talked about the evolutionary brain. So compassion has to be part of the evolutionary formula there. And if it's in there somewhere, we have to be able to learn it or relearn it.
Right, to reconnect with that part of ourselves. It's been taught and learned for thousands of years. This is not something new, although it does seem like it's something that has generated some renewed interest in our culture. But maybe that's because we directed ourselves so far away from it. That It is true. I agree with Veronica that not everybody can learn to do it because not everybody has the inclination.
Mm.
The way that you begin to feel compassion is, first of all, by noticing the distress that others feel. And that takes a certain amount of courage and inner stability before you'd even be willing to consider that. But if you're willing to take a chance and see what happens, then it kind of unfolds naturally. It's not something that you learn about in isolation, and you don't learn to feel compassion from a book. It's an interpersonal kind of learning that happens in the company of others. And when people trust you and you trust them, there's some kind of opportunity for an exchange of experience that lets us feel what they're feeling. And that's the basis of compassion, that when we're held in compassion by someone else, we realize that it's possible for us to feel that way too. And the bottom line is that it just feels better.
Yeah, it sure does. So stress is all around and we do absorb it. So now what? What do we do with the stress we've absorbed? You can't always hang up the phone or walk out of the room.
It's a $64,000 question, but how about if we all just start by slowing down enough, taking a breath, and realizing that we're all just a little bit crazy. We're all reacting a little bit more than is necessary, and maybe we could just take a fresh start.
Yeah, and literally, Michael, literally take a breath and notice that you are breathing, literally. Literally
right.
Do that. It doesn't take a long time, and you don't have to alter your life.
We were just listening to Dr. Dan Gottlieb's conversation with Tamar Chansky and researchers Drs. Wendy Mendez and Sarah Waters from UC San Francisco about contagious stress. You're listening to Voices in the Family, and we'll be right back after this break.
This year, more than 750,000 Americans will suffer a stroke and need advanced medical care. You may learn about the signs of stroke by visiting christianacare.org/aboutstroke. Christiana Hospital has earned comprehensive stroke center certification from the Joint Commission and the American Heart Association and American Stroke Association by their commitment of meeting high standards for treating the most serious stroke cases. Christiana Care proudly supports WHYY.
I'm Robin Young. The grand bargain is Detroit's plan to avoid bankruptcy by reducing pensions somewhat in exchange for sparing the city's artwork.
The idea of protecting the Detroit Institute of Arts and also making sure pensioners are made pretty close to whole are popular ones.
But others owed money want that artwork sold. Next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
Welcome back to Voices in the Family. I'm Gita Simons, in for host Dr. Dan Gottlieb. Today, we're talking about contagious stress and its progression from infancy through adulthood. To explain how to keep from taking it in and passing it on, we'll hear Dr. Jon Kabat-Zinn, the creator of a very popular stress reduction program called Mindfulness-Based Stress Reduction, which is used all over the world. He is also Professor of Medicine Emeritus at the University of Massachusetts Medical School. In 2005, Dr. Gottlieb and Kabat-Zinn discussed how mindfulness is the antidote to stress. Let's listen to Dr. Gottlieb start by asking Kabat-Zinn why we lead such busy lives, even though we don't seem to enjoy doing it.
We believe our thoughts that describe the world to us without examining them. And I think it was, sometimes I've heard it attributed to Aristotle, sometimes to his teacher Plato, the unexamined life is not worth living. I mean, it lies at the absolute heart of our Western civilization. And yet, as a rule, we're not encouraged or even taught how to examine our lives, especially in a way that's friendly and not vicious and critical. So, this is actually an acquired skill, and while you say, yeah, it's hard or challenging to live in that way, I would kind of also respond, well, yeah, but what else is there to do? In a sense, you know, quoting that great yogi Bob Dylan, if you're not busy being born, you're busy dying. And it may be that we're busy dying much more than we're busy being born. I'm not talking about being reborn. I mean, just born to each moment. And in a sense, it's a choice whether we know we're making it or not. And when we are willing to inhabit the moment, one of the things that happens so amazingly is we do wake up, because it turns out, it sounds like a truism, but it's one of the most profound fulcra around which human beings can heal and transform. The present moment is the only moment in which we are ever alive. So if we can learn how to actually inhabit the present moment with the full repertoire of our capacities, and that doesn't mean just colored by thought, although we're not excluding thought from it, but with this kind of greater awareness, that examined life, then we have many more choices for how to navigate the ups and downs and the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune in ways that are empowering, transformative, healing, and nurturing of what I would call well-being or happiness. And that in the midst of all the stress, it's not like, oh, I got to get rid of all the stress and then that kind of thing can happen. No, it's that you use it all as kind of like fertilizer to nourish the soil of your own heart. So, and that's a discipline. It's a practice. It's not just a good idea.
So let's start with the process. When I learned mindfulness meditation 7, maybe 8 years ago now, there was a woman in the course who was terminally ill, and she appeared so. And I said to her, why would you take an 8-week course where you have to practice every day, where it takes a good 60, 70 years to get good at it? And at least, and she said to me, all my life, wherever I was somewhere else. And she said, in the time I have left, I want to be where I am. I want to read the opening quote from your brochure. Meditation is not for the faint-hearted, nor for those who routinely avoid the whispered longings of their own hearts. What's so hard about it?
I want to just linger for a moment in what you said before you read that quote, because the woman who was like terminally ill, if you will, she's basically affirming something that we all know, and that is, it doesn't matter what's already happened and over. The only possibility that we have for really living authentically is to drop in here and now. And actually, if you think about it, we all learned in elementary school that if you take a line that's like a foot long and you take a line that's an inch long, and I were to ask you, how many points, are there more points in the line that's a foot long than in an inch long, what would you say? It's the same, right? We've all taught that they're both an infinite number of points, and so there's as many points in a line that's an inch long as in a foot long. That's hard for the thinking mind to understand because we're not intimate with infinities, even though there are many infinities associated with our own being. So think of it this way. Take this woman who is going to die at some point, just like everybody else. Between now and the time that she was going to, between the time you asked her that question, the time she was going to die, there were actually an infinite number of moments, no matter how short or long that time was by the clock or the calendar. If she were to embrace her moments, good, bad, or ugly, and live them fully, what I heard her saying in response to you is, that is no longer a kind of luxury. That is an absolute necessity. That in some way I need to take care of living and let the dying take care of itself, rather than worrying constantly about the dying and in the process miss the living because it doesn't conform to the story we want to tell ourselves about how we'd be happy if only it were happening some other way.
Let's make this discussion a little bit less abstract. Could you teach us what mindfulness is for a couple minutes?
What we're talking about sounds totally trivial. Just hear what's here to be heard, see what's here to be seen, taste what's here to be tasted, feel what's here to be felt, know what's here to be known without the colorations of inaccurate thinking. What's the big deal? Well, it turns out it's very, very hard to do. And a lot of time we only hear what we want to hear. We see what we want to see. We're very conditioned and habitual. And so one has to actually train to cultivate that in-touchness that in a way is our birthright, but most of the time we are seriously asleep at the wheel around. So we live in kind of delusion that we're walking down the street, but we're really walking down the street in our head, and we're not seeing or feeling the air or whatever. So meditation really is about paying attention. That's all. There's nothing particularly magical, particularly mystical, particularly Eastern, Japanese, Tibetan, you know, Indian. It's about paying attention. It's completely universal. You don't have to give up your belief systems, adopt some other belief system, shave your head, wear robes, chant in the street, funny languages. It's just an invitation to drop in on yourself and to inhabit the moments that are ours to live, and there's only this moment. Most of the time, if you pay attention, your mind is someplace else. It's in the future. Pay attention to what's on your mind. Most of the time, it's either worrying or planning. Or it is in the past, blaming, you know, potentially blaming who's to blame for why I'm so miserable now, or how great it was in the good old days and compared to now. And I like to dispel the notion from the very beginning that meditation is about getting anywhere else or being better than you already are. First of all, it's impossible. The only place you can be is where you already are. So it's not about getting someplace else. It's about being where you actually are. And it's not about becoming better or self-improvement. It's about recognizing your wholeness right here, right now.
That was Jon Kabat-Zinn, creator of the Mindfulness Stress Reduction Program, speaking with Dr. Dan Gottlieb in our show about contagious stress, how we get it, when we get it, and what we can do about it. He also spoke with Drs. Michael Boehm, Wendy Mendez, Sarah Waters, and Tamar Chansky. Thank you for joining us. To download our podcasts, go to whyy.org/voices. Follow us on Twitter at Voices in the Fam. Email us at voices@whyy.org. The engineer for today's show has been Al Banks. Elizabeth Perez Luna is executive producer of audio content. Emily House is our production assistant. Lindsay Carfagno is our intern. Mike and Scott is our executive producer. I'm Gita Simons, producer of Voices in the Family, in for host Dr. Dan Gottlieb. Have a great week.
Does your son or daughter come home drunk or high? Would you like to learn new ways of dealing with their drug or alcohol use? The Family Training Program works with parents of children aged 12 to 25 to help them maintain control of their child's drug or alcohol problem. Held in Philadelphia by the Treatment Research Institute, a supporter of WHYY. More on the Family Training Program at 877-I-WORRY-2. That's 877-I-WORRY and the number 2. Or online at iamconcerned.org.
Have I stayed away too long?
On the next Fresh